from inside the WAER studios.
Long outlet pass, Ryan Simmons inside! He scores the game winner! Give the assist to Don Mandata! Syracuse wins!
Finds Guerrier, open, drives baseline, goes up, and hammers it home! Quincy Guerrier, hello!
And it's intercepted! Andre Sisco!
Flings it from 75 feet past the scoreboard, and he connected! Elijah Hughes throws up a prayer at the buzzer, and somehow it's answered!
It's the Ostrom Avenue Podcast.
The Orange, take the Camping World Bowl.
Syracuse gets the program signature win it always needed. Perhaps the biggest upset in program history.
Taj Harris passed the 45. He's past midfield. 30, 25, 20, 15, 10, 5. Touchdown, Syracuse.
And one, Joe Girard.
Three ball, Buddy Boeheim. He got all three of them. Huge shot from Buddy.
Pass point. Black got it. Game winner. Brendan Curry with the winner.
Hughes left wing charges and slams with the right hand.
Killing a three at the buzzer. Oh, it's good. He made it.
And here's your hosts, Owen Valentine and Ben Shulman.
Welcome into the Ostrom Avenue Podcast. Owen Valentine, Ben Shulman talking Syracuse basketball today. They have had their early ups and downs, both on the court and off the court. And yesterday was no different, Ben. Just narrowly outdoing Northeastern, 62-56, the final. Northeastern was leading in the second half for a good portion of the game. And Syracuse able to figure it out at the end, seemingly, but not really in terms of, you know, truly figuring things out. They just sort of outlasted Northeastern in a game of pretty poor offensive showings. And, you know, they're able to get the win, but a win is a win. And Jim Boeheim said so after the game. Bryant and Northeastern, you usually have to learn your lesson with a loss. And they have now learned the lesson twice, that anyone can come out and play on any day. And you've got to be on your game every time you touch the hardwood. And they have been able to learn that lesson twice without a loss. So a little silver lining there for Syracuse in two, you know, pretty poor performances when you look to the season opener against Bryant and then last night against Northeastern, but still able to get the win there. Now 5-1 on the season. A lot of interesting stuff. We've been having all the coverage for you on Twitter at WAER Sports Talk for some of our stuff, but I can't seem to get my Twitters lined up ever. We're also going to shout out our own Twitter here at Ostrom Avenue Pod on Twitter. We've been having a lot of fun over there. We will, you know, get back into our ACC predictions poll. I don't want to, you know, get too ahead of myself, but I have a perfect 3-0 start here. So if you are a betting man, maybe it's time to tail Owen's picks, even though it was just a single game of predictions. And I didn't even necessarily want to take the over, but we took the over and it hit. And so here we are at 3-0. You can follow us at Ostrom Avenue Pod on Twitter for those updates. Ben, a pretty scrappy game yesterday for Syracuse. And it wasn't a game that, you know, when you're coming off one of the biggest wins in conference history for Syracuse just a few days back against Boston College, and you fall as flat as they did yesterday, it's not really all smiles in the Syracuse locker room anymore.
Far from it. There were very few smiles yesterday through Jim Boeheim's see-through mask, which was his first repeat look of the season, as we tweeted out. But yeah, it's a polar opposite game in many ways. I mean, you look at three-point shooting, which was a single-game record for SU in the last game, 16 made threes. In this game, the Orange shot 2-for-18 from beyond the arc and really couldn't make shots from all over the floor. It was not just the three-point game. In the second half, Syracuse was 7-of-29 from the field, which for anyone watching made it not the most entertaining game of basketball ever. But there was control down low with Quincy Guerrier and Marek Dolezal, who combined to shoot 13-for-23. And their performances, along with some help from Joe Girard, really allowed the Orange to take it away with a few minutes left in the second half. But yeah, not a great performance. And unlike Bryant, where you can lean back and say, okay, it was the first game of the season and Syracuse only had one practice, this game, Syracuse scheduled it knowing the amount of practice time the Orange would have. And this was right after, as you said, the best ACC margin of victory in Syracuse history, and they just had a letdown. There's no way around it. Two guys who usually score didn't score, and SU narrowly escaped with a win against an opponent that really most people thought didn't have any business playing in their realm.
One of the big stats from the early going that has really jumped out to me is, you know, they played six games so far this season, and outside of the BC and the Rider games, Syracuse is shooting 24 for 101 from three. That is under 24% from deep. And then obviously in the BC and Rider game, shooting above 50%. Now, we know this is a team that shoots a lot of threes, and you always hear the phrase, you live and die by the three. But what Syracuse really has, it's the close games. They're not shooting the ball well from three. And that is something that they need to improve on, and at least finding a bit more consistency. But something that I know you're really pumped about, in a conversation that we need to have with regards to this Rider game, or to this Northeastern game, has to do with the play of Quincy Guerrier down low. And Ben, your take that he should start over Alan Griffin if things make themselves out to be what we saw at the start of the season. If Barama comes back and you go Barama, Marek, Buddy, and Joe, and there's one more spot, your take to have Quincy Guerrier down low over Alan Griffin seems to be coming to pretty good fruition.
Well, I think he's just dominant. I think he was the best player for Syracuse yesterday. And really, I think while he hasn't been the best player in every game, you know, one game it's been Buddy. Even recently, Allen was probably the best player in a game. And Marek was the best player in the opener. I think consistently, Guerrier has been one of the few guys who's had, you know, about 10 rebound performances every game. And obviously no one else is expected really to have 10 rebound performances. But what I mean is he's doing what we expect him to do every game. So Allen, while at his best, is a better scorer probably. And he's definitely a better 3-point shooter. I don't think he's a better rebounder. I think he's a good rebounder, but not a better rebounder. And when he's bad, like, he's looked really bad. He's still, in my eyes, a bit of a microwave, and that's kind of what he was last year, a guy who at times can heat up really hot, but at times is dead cold. And I think having him come off the bench might make better sense because, you know, if he comes in and he hits a couple shots quickly, all right, you know, let Alan Griffin play more minutes than Quincy Guerrier. I have no problem with that. But Syracuse needs stability on a team that is incredibly inconsistent, as you mentioned. And I think Quincy is one of the few sources of stability, both on defense and on offense for this team.
One of the big, you know, attributes to his stability is just the number of high percentage shots he's taking. His play style and his rebounding gives him a lot of easy putbacks and just a lot of simple finishes, the way he's been able to get open and body some guys down low this season. Whereas, you know, you look at Alan Griffin and Buddy Boeheim, guys that are more, and even throw Joe Girard into that mix, guys who are, you know, more heavily reliant on the three, there's a lot more, you know, discrepancy in individual game stats. Obviously, it sort of evens itself out throughout the entire season, but there are definitely stretches where these guys are going to go cold. And unfortunately for Syracuse, Alan Griffin, Buddy Boeheim, 1 for 16 from the floor yesterday. And Joe Girard finishes with 21 points, but he was only 5-16 from the field, which is not where you want to see him at, especially when you're seeing that he only took nine threes. He took a lot of threes yesterday, but when he's taking six shots inside the arc and still shooting at that clip from the floor on the day as a whole, is not a great sign. So it's something that you definitely have to consider moving forward, because Guerrier is the consistency because of the shot selection. And that's what happens when you finally, I mean, everyone wants to talk about when will Syracuse get this competent big once again. They have the competent big. And unfortunately, he's not a five, and he's more of a combo guy now that you've seen that he can shoot the three. I think Quincy's going to have, you know, 15 to 20 points pretty much every game this season, just because of the way his play style has created it.
And it's funny. We talked about Alan Griffin replacing the scoring of Elijah Hughes. 15 to 20 points every night, while it might be in a very different way, that sounds a lot like me to Quincy Guerrier replacing the scoring of Elijah Hughes. I think right now he's the starter. I think, you know, we're about to get into to Buffalo coming up, and then Notre Dame is on Tuesday, and we probably won't have an episode before that. But the games are starting to count down here before Sidibe comes back. He was sitting on the bench yesterday, and it's only about two more weeks, I believe, until his estimated return. The burden of proof right now, to use a legal term, is on Griffin. Guerrier has the spot, in my opinion. Griffin has to come out and take it away from him. So I think right now it's Quincy Guerrier's job to lose, because he's just playing so well.
And maybe a discussion for a future episode, and we can get the ball rolling on Twitter at Ostrom Avenue Pod at some point this week, is what's the lineup you want to see when Barama Sidibe is healthy? Do you want Barama coming in at the five, or do you want Barama to be sort of a bench aspect and keep things where they are? Marek has shown himself that he can, you know, be physical-ish down low. He had some physicality yesterday and even, you know, bodied the guy down low for a second, which is something you don't actually see him do all too often. But is that a question that you have moving forward? When Barama is healthy and back, do you still want Marek at the five and to continue running with this lineup? And then you've got a bench of Barama and Woody Newton and Kadari Richmond. Do you want to start rolling with that and having those three guys off the bench instead of switching it up and putting Alan Griffin to the side here and having him become a sixth man? It's definitely not what he was promised here at Syracuse when, you know, the transfer pitch was out there, but it's something that he can do and is a conversation that needs to be had. Is that something that could be more beneficial for Syracuse? I'm not sure. So we'll give you the sort of brief, what do we want out of the lineup now? But I mean, there's going to be a lot of questions in a week or so when Barama is back and healthy as to, do you want to start Barama at the five or do you want to keep Marek and roll with this situation that has seemingly worked out all right for the Orange?
It's interesting. I don't know if I've come to a verdict yet, because I'd like to see Syracuse play more ACC competition, which they do in Notre Dame coming up next week. Because while I love Quincy Guerrier and I'll fly that flag for a while, these still are a lot of smaller non-conference teams. And while, again, you're much more of a Sidibe supporter than I am, I won't deny that he is good for rebounding. And if we're talking about him versus Griffin, you know, it's, I know a lot of people will say, well, Griffin averages about the same rebounds, but it's different. And if you already have Dolezal and Guerrier coming off the wings, both of those guys can rebound better than Griffin. This is about getting a better rebounder in the middle where Sidibe replaces Dolezal. So I think I'm holding out for now, which is a bit of a cop-out, but I want to see if Syracuse can manage against more ACC teams on the glass. Then, yeah, I probably would keep Sidibe out, maybe bring him off the bench. You know, he has some of those outburst games where he just, like, randomly goes 15 and 10. Maybe off the bench, if he has high energy the whole time and can worry a little less about fouling, he can have more of those. Maybe the totals won't be as high, but maybe he goes 8-6 in limited minutes more than going 8-6 in an entire game, because – he can be more aggressive and use all of his energy at once and not have to worry about staying passive to stay in the game.
They've got an interesting test coming up on Saturday where Buffalo, you know, presents a little bit more size down low. Syracuse has had some good matchups regarding its opposing bigs throughout the season, but they've got a big task on Saturday with regards to Brock Bertram, who isn't the biggest scorer, but as a 6'11 bigger body down low is an interesting challenge for the Orange inside the paint. And Syracuse has had their issues with COVID, and so has UB, it appears. And we spoke with, Ben spoke with Jenna Colari. She's the sports anchor and an MMJ for WKBW over in Buffalo. And she'll give the reason why they will be playing without their head coach come Saturday.
I have the pleasure of being joined by Jenna Colari. She's a sports anchor and multimedia journalist with WKBW. Jenna, thank you so much for coming on today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk a little Buffalo basketball. Before we do, though, you also cover a lot of the Buffalo Bills, who are having their best season in a really long time. But I have to ask, what is it like to cover the Bills without their legendary frenzied fan base there? I mean, there's no one breaking tables or anything, despite the fact they're winning so many games.
I know, it's so weird. So I was actually born and raised in Buffalo. We moved away. My dad got a new job in Michigan. So I haven't been back, you know, in years. But, you know, when I was little, I attended games. And my dad would always take me later because he didn't want me to see everything that was going on in tailgating lots. And, you know, I came here in 2017. I covered the Bills. But, you know, in a sports department, there's three people. And I was kind of bottom of the totem pole. And so I instead would anchor while, you know, the two guys in front of me would go to the games. But I did have the opportunity to go to Jacksonville for the first playoff game. And I will always remember this. I was walking to the stadium and, you know, I got a message from our assignment desk saying, hey, you know, can you just go get a tailgating Bosat? So I go outside and I could not, people were telling me, you know, what lot they were in. And I'm like, I don't know where they are. So I go up to this cop and I'm like, you know, I'm like, you look like you know what you're doing. I'm like, I'm looking for, you know, like, let's just say like the B lot. And he like looked at me and I'll always remember this. He took off his sunglasses. And he like kind of pulled them down and he looked at me. He's like, follow the fireworks. And I kind of looked at him like, what do you mean follow the fireworks? And he's like, follow the fireworks. Sure enough, I hear like sparklers and things going off. And as soon as you got close, it was like, you went from like, you know, calm land to like wild jungle. I mean, it was just the things that people were doing were insane. But you can't not love Bills Mafia. I mean, yes, I know that they're crazy. I know sometimes they get a bad rap. But look at what they've been doing outside of the tailgating. You have, you know, the donations that they made to Andy Dalton years ago, even that Baltimore, I think it was Baltimore broadcaster that called us like the city of losers. And then people like donated to the Alzheimer's Association. And then, you know, the latest with Josh Allen's grandma. I started taping Bills games when our sports director, Joe Biscaglia, left. I think it was like 2 years ago or something. And my first game, I mean, I came from covering SEC football. So I was used to like Auburn, Alabama, Georgia. That was crazy. But Bills Mafia is on a whole different level. I mean, it's just, and even inside the stadium, it's just like, there were times where I couldn't even like hear myself think. Like I physically almost got distracted shooting because it was just, it's unlike any atmosphere I've ever been a part of. And it's weird. It is weird not having Bills Mafia games. It's now granted, we're not allowed to shoot the game. Media is very different this year. We have one pool photo, so I'm not even allowed to go to games anymore. And I can tell you right now, it just wouldn't be the same shooting without the fans, you know, screaming, I want to be on TV and, you know, kind of pumping that team up. It's just, it's so weird. And, you know, of course, the Bills would be having one of their best seasons when Bills Mafia is not allowed inside the stadium. It's just, it's true. Hashtag Buffalo problems.
Well, I went to a Bills game last year when everything was still normal, and I'm a Green Bay Packers fan, so I'm used to a pretty polar opposite environment of tailgating. When I walked out of the stadium after the game, and there were SWAT trucks down the street as I was leaving, that was an eye-opening experience. But everyone was very nice to me. No one did anything bad, and I enjoyed my time with Bills Mafia a lot. You mentioned you can't be there at the stadiums, and obviously the same for the most part can be said for the University of Buffalo, whether it has been football or basketball. What has the media experience been like so far with UB?
Yeah, it's been weird. You know, typically in August, we would be going to, you know, football training camp, and, you know, then we didn't know if they were going to have a season, and they started a season, but we have not been allowed to any UB football practice this year. As far as games, they do let us shoot, but we're not really allowed to roam the sidelines like we used to. We have to either shoot from the stands with a mask on the entire time. Or if we want to go field level, we have to stand like behind these barricades in the end zone. And you know, there, you don't know what kind of angle you're going to get. So we've kind of gotten used to shooting in the stands. Basketball, same thing. We would go to practice all the time just to get new footage and sound. And we don't have access to practice. Everything obviously is via Zoom. For games, we have to shoot from, you know, the 100 level. So we can't even, you know, it's just, It's very different and it's weird, you know, and it's, we understand that it's all about safety, but it's just weird to not have the access you're used to. And I hate to say it, but you kind of wonder if this is kind of going to become the norm. You know, if they're not going to let us shoot, you know, practices, and, you know, UB, specifically their basketball press conference room, it is a closet. It is so small. And they've joked for years, you know, hey, we're getting good. We're going to have to expand this room. There's no way that they were going to be able to hold media this year. So we knew something was going to change. It's just sad. You know, it's just weird. You know, as a member of the media, you enjoy going to practices. You enjoy getting to know these guys and, you know, women. And we can't, because we can't be there to, you know, see everything and do everything we want to do.
And I want to get to the situation with basketball in a second, but how did COVID, from a standpoint of cases, or maybe how it affected the roster, what impact did it have on the football season?
I think just the whole fact that they didn't even know if they were going to have a season. You know, back in August, the MAC was the first, I believe, conference to say, hey, we're not going to play. And then you saw other conferences take part. And then, you know, they came back and, you know, did it. But, you know, when you're a MAC team and you're only given, I think it was a 6-game schedule. And then, you know, UB had one of their games called a no contest because they couldn't play because the other program, I think it was Ohio, you know, had cases within their program to where they just couldn't field a roster and they couldn't play. And I think that's the biggest toll that it's taken on these players is, you know, they already had to go through the ups and downs of not having a season. Then they go through the ups and downs of only being able to play 6 games. Then they go through the ups and downs of not being able to play one of their games and possibly not clinching a spot in the MAC championship, you know, depending on what happened, you know, with other teams. And it's sad, you know, it's something, again, that I think all of these players just never expected to happen. And it's different. It's different for everybody. I mean, we say it's hard on us on the media. I can't even imagine what it's being like as a football athlete. You know, I mean, just take a look around the entire NCAA with games just being canceled left and right. And, you know, Ohio State didn't even think they were going to be able to play in the Big Ten championship. And then, you know, the conference made an exception. It's happening everywhere. And it's just a very weird season.
And it's been a weird start for the basketball team. I mean, on the floor, it's been fine, 3-2 so far, but their head coach is not positive for COVID, but contact traced. And now he's been out for multiple games, will be out for the Syracuse game, it seems, as well. You know, from press conferences or whatever, what kind of impact do you think it's had on the team not having a coach there?
Yeah, you know, believe it or not, we actually haven't heard from the men since Weitzel sent out that statement. Just because, again, we really haven't had press conferences, had conference access. But I can tell you right now that, you know, Jim coached from the stands against Mercyhurst, and he had his one assistant behind the bench. And I mean, you know, the team won, they did fine, and they won this past, you know, week. I'm blanking on the opponent they took on, but it's, you know, I just think it's something where I think in a typical season you would say, oh, you know, it's a shame. But I feel like these athletes have gone through so much already that it doesn't really phase them. Obviously, it phases them a little bit mentally because, you know, as a basketball team, you're a family. You never want to see one of, you know, your members not be able to participate, you know, especially a guy like Jim. But I think that they know that this is kind of the new norm, and it's going to probably happen again within, you know, with a player, with a coach. And, you know, I think at the beginning of the season, I think it was Jonathan Williams who said that, you know, they have to hold each other accountable, that, you know, they didn't know if they were going to have a season. And now that they do have a season and things are different, they can't afford to be reckless, and they can't afford, you know, to put themselves in a position to where, you know, some of them could be out for games because, you know, they came in close contact with someone. Now, Jim, again, tested negative, and I'm sure he's probably the least reckless guy I know, but you have to be cautious. And I think it just kind of shows that he's putting his team first, and he doesn't want to, you know, make an impact on the rest of the team. Just God forbid something happened. You know, I think it says a lot about him, is that, you know, he doesn't want to put the team at risk, and he's, you know, thinking about the team. He's putting the team first before himself, because I think any coach wouldn't want to miss any practices or any games, but he's willing to do that. And, you know, you think back to 2 years ago when Nate Oates was head coach of the team. If Nate Oates had to leave, it would be Jim Weitzel stepping up and taking, you know, over the bench. So I think, you know, Jim has all the confidence in the world and the assistants. And I think the guys do too, because for the most part, if you ever go to a UB practice, Jim's conducting practice, but a lot of the times the assistants are running drills and going through things with the guys. So I think it's kind of, you know, unfortunately business as usual, just because it's kind of become the new norm. I mean, with so many coaches around the country testing positive or coming in close contact and having to miss games, I wouldn't be surprised if the majority of teams were without their coach for at least one game this season.
Well, Syracuse had it, but I guess, well, it's never fortunate, but they had it before the season. So it seems like right now, Jim Boeheim is at least somewhat in the clear. You mentioned him coaching from the stands against Mercyhurst. How exactly did that work? Is it, you know, was it on the phone? Is he given signs like a baseball coach?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure. I wasn't there, but so you saw a video, and you know, the benches are all very, like, it's not even a bench anymore. It's kind of like guys spread out on chairs. And we saw Jim, he was in, I would say he was probably 10 to 15 rows from the court up. He was standing the entire time, you know, making signals. I just think it was kind of one of those things where he could only do what he could from the stands. He knew that, you know, the assistants on the bench were the ones that were going to be calling things out, you know, talking to these guys in the huddles. And I think he wanted to be there just from a standpoint. I mean, it was kind of a last minute thing. He just wanted to be there from a standpoint of like, hey, I'm here to support you guys. But I think it was also a good test just to kind of teach these guys, hey, you know, we may not be here. So yeah, I'm here, but try not to look up. You know, I think maybe almost that's why he stood so far away, is because, you know, the coach on the bench was the one calling the shots, and they kind of had to, you know, kind of pay attention to their own little bubble. But I wish I was there. We had, you know, we had to record a Bill show, which is why I missed that game. But I kind of wish I was there just to kind of see what, I wish I just would have had a camera on him for like 5 or 10 minutes just to see kind of what he's doing. Because I think any coach, they can't help a coach. Even if, you know, the guys can't hear them. I imagine that, you know, he was flailing his arms and going crazy the entire time just because that's just kind of in his DNA.
Yeah, it's like, it's like a caged dog having him up there 12 yeah. rows back. And it's, so it's Whitesell's second year. You talked about Nate Oates a little before. He obviously brought Buffalo basketball to a point where it really had never been before. And Whitesell's first year doesn't exactly go to plan. There's bigger expectations this year to bring it back to prominence. Do you think some of those expectations from fans or media have been brought down a little just by the sheer randomness of COVID?
I think so. I think that's with any program. You know, and I think people need to remember that, you know, Jim took over this program after they lost that incredible roster of, you know, they had CJ Massenburg, Perkins, they had Jeremy Harris, Devontae Carruthers. I mean, they had a really good starting five, and who were all so talented in their own different ways. And, you know, then Jim takes over and he has a much younger and less experienced squad. This year, they do have a lot of those guys like Jonathan Williams, Sagu, you know, Josh Mbala. You know, a lot of those guys have that experience under their belt now, and it's going to take a while to build this program back. But I mean, that's with any program. You know, you've seen Duke have up and down years. You've seen Kentucky. I mean, I don't know what they're doing this year. You know, you've seen programs have their ups and downs, especially with a coaching change. But I think it all starts with the guy at the helm. And, you know, Jim wants to bring this program back to where it is. And I think that's the most important thing. And he served under Nate Oates. So he knows, you know, what it takes to have a winning program. He you know, he instills a lot of the same thing to these guys. You know, so I think, you know, the expectation is good. I don't think the expectations are as high as everyone thought, just because the season is so different. You don't know what's going to happen with a roster on any single given week. But I also think that's, I hate to say it, but I kind of think that's the same for football. Like, I even, you know, I'm a huge college football fan, and I don't even know if I can even say like, oh yeah, you know, the champion this year is a true champion, because you just wonder what would be different, you know, if things change. I mean, you look at Clemson with that one loss. Well, yeah, they didn't have Trevor Lawrence for, you know, what was that, like 2 or 3 weeks. So it's just kind of like, I think expectations for every single team are different, just because this is kind of one of those things where you truly just don't know how the season is going to go and how it's going to impact a team individually.
Well, that loaded Massenburg team was the first Buffalo team to defeat Syracuse in 2000.
We were there.
Perhaps Whitesell can make it two in a row. That would be a big statement for this year. Jenna Kalari, WKBW, thank you so much for coming on today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thank you. And I hope you guys are staying healthy. I know it's probably, you know, kind of the same. You guys are going through kind of the same thing that we're going through. So hopefully, you know, in a year or two, we can, you know, this is all back to normal. We can all see each other at games and, you know, actually talk without masks and just kind of, you know, kind of go back to somewhat of a little bit of a normalcy.
Maybe have some podcast interviews, not over Zoom.
Yes, exactly.
Well, thank you again. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Another thank you to Jenna Kalari for that info on the whole situation over at UB and the reason that the Bulls will be playing come Saturday without Jim Weitzel, and a tough situation for them, as Syracuse learned early on. It's a situation that, you know, can do whatever it wants with the COVID protocols this year, and it's going to have a lot of teams playing in different situations. Syracuse playing a game or two or three without a starter already and having to quarantine because of Jim Boeheim testing positive early on. It's something that is going to be a recurring theme and a recurring motif throughout this whole 2020 and 2021 season for all of college basketball. But it's the situation that is what it is over at in Buffalo. And Syracuse learned the hard way a couple of years back with Jim Boeheim out due to suspension when that whole situation came about, and the different, you know, issues with Jim Boeheim and different punishments came about, and it wasn't the same. I mean, they're playing a non-con schedule then, and Mike Hopkins, as we've seen, is a capable coach on his own, but it's a tough situation to be put into a spot where you don't have a choice, and this is now going to be an altered situation and something that the Bulls will have to deal with on Saturday for one final game. And to look a little bit more into, you know, who will be there on Saturday, we were able to catch up with Josh Wetzel. He's the UB basketball radio play-by-play, and he gave a lot more onto the ins and outs of this Bulls squad. We're now joined by Josh Wetzel. He is the radio play-by-play for the University at Buffalo basketball team and also works with the Rochester Red Wings. Josh, thank you so much for coming on today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
No problem. How is how's everything going COVID-wise for you? I know you know, the UB program has had its ups and downs in the early going, but everything all right for you right now?
Yeah, I'm doing okay. I take it pretty careful with this whole deal. I'm not actually going to be at the Carrier Dome Saturday for the game. I'm going to be broadcasting that remotely from my kitchen table. So it's been a little bit different in that regard. But yeah, as far as the program is concerned, Coach Jim Weitzel, the head coach, will not be there Saturday. He's missed the last couple of games as well. He doesn't have COVID, but he was in contact with someone who does have COVID, or at least tested positive for COVID. And so due to the Erie County contact tracing protocols, he has to quarantine for, I think, 10 days or 14 days. And so he's not going to be there, unfortunately, for the game Saturday.
Before we get into basketball, I wanted to hit quickly on the whole, you know, situation with the Bills right now. The Bills are playing unbelievably, but no one can really be there to celebrate. How weird is it to see the Bills have this sort of season that has been so, you know, unbelievable compared to everything they've done in the past, and not really be able to have that same communal support in terms of, you know, tailgating, being at the games and going out afterwards and all that stuff.
Jumping on tables and all that kind of crazy stuff. Yeah. I mean, I'm not a Bills fan, but the Bills fans, I think it's driving them crazy because the team is one of the best, obviously, in the league. And nobody can get out there and do some of the crazy shenanigans that Bills fans are notorious for. It gets a little, I've been to a few games over there, and that atmosphere in the parking lot is pretty insane. I would not necessarily describe it as a family atmosphere, put it that way.
100%.
Steering back towards, you know, UB athletics, how has your coverage been so far with COVID? What's been different? Maybe what's been the same, and how has that, you know, affected what's going out on air?
It's affected it a lot. You know, I mean, again, I'm someone who very, very seriously takes this whole situation. So I don't necessarily mind not being on the road with the team. It's tough though, doing these remote games, especially at the level that UB is at. I don't have a ton of extra resources. We're not getting audio from the arena. So we're pumping in, fake crowd noise in the background of the broadcast to make it sound a little bit better. There are certain, you know, basketball actually has been more difficult to broadcast remotely than I expected it would be, because you don't see who's subbing in. fouls that get called away from the ball, a lot of times you're just kind of guessing who the foul is on. I've had some buffering issues doing some of these games, and just, you know, not being around the team, I just don't have quite the same feel for what is happening with the team necessarily. And you just don't know quite as much about what's going on. So it's certainly not an ideal situation. And I hope when this is all over that broadcasters are back to traveling with teams and we can be around the team a lot more. You know, again, they're not, even if I wanted to go on the road, Buffalo and Learfield would not let me right now, which again, I don't have any problem with. But even for the home games, and we've only had one home game that I was able to broadcast, but for the home game, you know, we're wearing masks, which is, you know, it's not very comfortable, but it seems like the right thing to do. So it's been a mess, but you know, I'm just glad I'm able to broadcast some of these games, no matter how it might be taking place.
We'll start with a sort of, you know, macro look at this team right now. And 2 years ago, almost to the exact day, I think tomorrow is the exact day, 2 years ago, UB comes into the Dome and picks up a comfortable win against Syracuse. And obviously a lot of turnaround since that game has happened. But what do you sort of see as the biggest changes in terms of how the team is playing and approaching games since then?
Well, yeah, personnel-wise, that's the biggest thing. I mean, it's a lot of those guys, well, almost all of those guys are gone, with the exception really of two or three players. And the head coach is gone. Nate Oates is now at Alabama. Most of the other coaches are the same guys. But, you know, it's been a roster turnover. And I think the big thing that made that group of Buffalo players so good that year and the year before is just their talent level was a lot better than everybody else in the Mid-American Conference. And, you know, I know Nate Oates at the time said, you know, he didn't consider that to be an upset when Buffalo beat Syracuse. He thought Buffalo just had a better team. And, you know, I tend to agree with him on that. At that point in time, Buffalo just had really, really good talent. And that's not to take anything away from the talent that they have now, but it's just, I mean, that was a top 25 group. That was a legit top 25 team. And so the talent isn't maybe quite what it was then, but they have good players still, and they have a lot of players that are returning from last year. So a lot of experience still with this group. And I think they should be right in the thick of things in the Mid-American Conference again.
Obviously we're going to delve deep into the roster here, but the coaching change, I think, stands out to a lot of people just because Oates brought the program to such a high level before he ended up going south to Alabama. Whitesell was one of his assistants. Has there been any major changes schematically, or for the most part, does this team run a similar system that it did for the four previous years with Oates?
Yeah, it's been pretty similar, I would say. Whitesell was very influential in what they did defensively. And previously, when Whitesell had been a head coach at Loyola in Chicago, offensively, he did not run at nearly the tempo that Buffalo has under Nate Oates and now Coach Whitesell. And I think this is a credit to Coach Whitesell that, you know, he's a little bit of an older coach at this point. I think he's 60, 61 years old. So he was in his 50s then as an assistant coach for Nate Oates. And he recognized that was a pretty fun way to play offensively, very up-tempo, a lot of shots, just a really fast pace, and also that players in general like to play that way. And so he has tried to continue basically the exact same style offensively that they had before. So there were very, very few changes whatsoever schematically. I think this year, I think they are changing a little bit, at least they have so far. And basically that's manifested itself in that they're not taking quite as many three-pointers, at least at this point. They also maybe don't have as good a three-point shooters. And last year they did not shoot at a very good percentage. And so he felt that was maybe a change they needed to make. So I think it's going to be interesting moving forward, you know, by the time we get to the end of this season, to see how many threes they take. If it continues to be kind of a decreased percentage from three-point range or not. I think that obviously remains to be seen. And that probably will be very interesting to see on Saturday, because a key for the Bulls will probably have to be whether they knock down three-pointers or not.
One of the big things that Coach Boeheim was alluding to approaching this game is the 3-point defense and just the UB defense as a whole. So what are you sort of seeing out of them? Is it individual guys that are the keys to it? Is it the scheme as a whole? Or what has led to the defensive success that has sort of been, you know, seen in the early going for the Bulls?
Well, you know, 2 years ago when Buffalo went into the Carrier Dome and won, they had guys like Devontae Jordan and Dante Carruthers and C.J. Massenburg who were really, really good on the ball defenders. And they made it very difficult for Syracuse and all sorts of teams to get into their offense because they were just so good on the perimeter defensively. Those guys aren't around anymore. Devontae Jordan was the MAC Defensive Player of the Year last year as a senior. It's not that these guys aren't good defenders, but they're just not as good as those guys. Now, on the flip side of that, I know the coaching staff feels like this year's team is longer defensively than maybe some they've had in the last 2 or 3 years. So they've given something up on the perimeter in terms of quickness and just quality on the ball defenders, but they have a little more length. The coaches were not real happy with the defense the first 2 or 3 games this season, although they were missing 1 or 2 players in those games. But the defense has been seemingly a lot better the last couple of games. And I know they were especially happy with the defense the last time out against Miami.
Who sparked that turnaround on defense this season? Is it Mbala or it's, who came back to really make a big difference?
Well, Mbala came back. He had missed all the games except for the first one, and he really didn't play that much in the first game. But I think it's just the coaches hounding the players to get better. You know, I think it comes down to that from what I can tell. Again, I'm not around them as much as I would like to be, but they just were much happier with how they played defensively in that second conference game against Miami. And really, they did a pretty good job the first conference game, too, against Bowling Green until the end. You know, they went into a drought at the end, and then Justin Turner kept getting fouled and made – one free throw after another the last 3 or 4 minutes of the game to win it for Bowling Green. But I think it's been more of a team thing. And Mbala played relatively limited minutes in the last game anyway, but he's certainly the big addition to the team after missing the previous 3 or 4.
The big question when it comes to players for Syracuse in the early going and opposing personnel has been the big man down low at the, with the loss of Barama Sidibe in game one. So a lot of focus on who is going to be sort of matching up with the opposing five, as Syracuse doesn't really have a true center out on the court right now. Brock Bertram seems like he's been the guy, missed a game and then was back in some capacity against Miami, Ohio the other day. Is he 100% or what is the situation with him and what is there to expect with him on the court?
Yeah, I think he's 100% or at least pretty close. You know, Brock, came in from Minnesota. He played high school basketball with guys like Trey Jones and Gary Trent Jr. They were all on the same team in Apple Valley, Minnesota. Redshirted his first year and honestly did not play a whole lot his first 2, 3, 4 years at UB. And he has looked good this year. To his credit, he has worked very hard in the offseason. You know, he's not going to score very many points, but he can grab rebounds. He's been blocking some shots. He will probably not be a big impact in the game Saturday in terms of what you see in the box score at the end of the game, but he knows how to play, sets good screens, all that type of stuff that coaches love. And it's interesting now that Mbala is back, you might see the two of them in the game at the same time, which is something you never saw last year. I don't know if Mbala and Bertram played together last year at all, because Mbala was playing the five a lot as kind of an undersized five. He's playing more of a four this season when he can with Bertram in there. So it is a little bit different this year with both of those guys in the game at the same time. It remains to be seen, I think, how much Mbala will play even on Saturday. That could be a key for Buffalo, because the more he's able to play, likely the better they will be. I mean, Mbala is a high major talent. He went to Texas Tech out of high school, and he was on the team that finished runner-up to Virginia in the national championship game before he transferred. So he's a very good player. It's just a question of whether he's going to be able to contribute as much as they would like on Saturday.
Yeah, big thing for teams playing Syracuse has been trying to shut down Quincy Guerrier, because while they don't have a true center for the Orange, the power forward position has been kind of a strength with Guerrier just out-muscling a lot of the fours he's seen so far. If Mbala can't go for extended minutes because he looks like the guy who physically matches up best to Guerrier, how do they provide size at the four position to try and counter that rebounding for SU?
Probably would be Trayvon Fagan, who missed all of last year with a knee injury and is back now this season and has actually played pretty well. He's been doing a nice job and he's been in there. Again, not somebody that is going to probably score that many points, but he's been grabbing some rebounds. He's been playing okay defense. So Trayvon Fagan would likely be the guy in that scenario. And quite honestly, I think there's a good chance Fagan starts Saturday, even if Mbala is doing pretty well physically, because I wouldn't be surprised to see them bring Mbala off the bench for a while. That's something they did the last probably 2 months of the previous season. And Mbala seemed to take pretty well to that kind of a six man type role.
This name to watch so far, it seems like, has been Jonathan Williams, and, you know, coming out and hitting the 20-point mark or threshold twice so far this season, but being on the brink of it seemingly every game. He has been outstanding in the early going from everything I can see. What are some of his biggest attributes, best attributes, and what is there to know about him coming into this matchup on Saturday?
Well, he's a kid from Rochester who supposedly was offered a full ride by Syracuse coming out of high school, but elected to go to Buffalo, which is an interesting story concerning Jonathan, but, you know, he ended up going to UB. He's got a really interesting game. He's listed at 6'5", but he has really long arms. He's left-handed and just looks kind of funky out there. I mean, I've always described his jump shot looks like an athletic right-hander shooting left-handed. You know, if I shoot left-handed, I look ridiculous, really, really bad. Jonathan looks like he's an athletic right-hander that can kind of pull off a left-handed shot. It just looks kind of strange, but I mean, he was a terrible three-point shooter as a freshman. I think he went 5 for 47, but then it got much better last year and it's better this year. And he's worked really hard on being able to go to his right because he previously was so left-handed. Everybody knew he was going to go to his left, but he's gotten better in that regard too. And he's just kind of a slasher. He's going to take the ball right to the basket. And again, he's just kind of funky, you know, in that left-handed kind of way. And it works for him. And now he's going to be a little bit undersized against Syracuse at 6'5", but he does have the long arms, which helps him out. And, you know, he and Rondo Segu both came in together as freshmen, and they're joined at the hip. It's like they're if you see one, you're going to see the other. And they are basketball junkies. They're in the gym constantly. The coaches always talk about that. And it's manifested itself in the way that they've gotten better during their time in college. They are good examples of how when you work really, really hard that you can improve. And that's what's happened with those two guys. They're just in the gym all the time, working on their game and getting better. And it's really paid off.
I mean, you can see in the stats, Williams has doubled pretty much every average they track in almost the same amount of minutes as he was playing last year. Obviously, he's taking more shots. But a guy who's taking less shots than him that I was a bit surprised about for the first few games is Javon Graves. I kind of thought that he would be the for sure leader of the team in terms of production coming into the year. And he's not having a bad year. He's having about the same year as he had last season. Is he still, you know, considered the number one guy, or has Williams kind of usurped that position from him?
I think when it's all said and done at the end of the year, Javon will probably have the most points per game on the team. That would be my guess. One of the things that's happened this year with Devontae Jordan having graduated is Javon is having to play a little bit of the point. And I think he's taken to that a little bit, trying to facilitate things and share the ball a little bit more, maybe at least in the last couple of games, especially. I thought against Miami the last time out, he was really good at not forcing things. If the shot wasn't there, he tried to get it to another guy who might be open and get him a shot. So I think that's the biggest reason maybe his numbers are down a little bit. You know, he declared for the NBA draft after last season, even though obviously I think everybody knew he was going to wind up coming back to college. But any feedback he did get was that, you know, you need to play point guard some, you know, and at the professional level, you're going to have to probably play some point. And so I think he's worked on that aspect of his game. And you'll probably see him play a little bit of point guard on Saturday too.
One of the sort of stats that jumped off the page for me in terms of team as a whole was, you know, under 24% of UB's points are scored from the three, whereas Syracuse defensively has been allowing, you know, higher numbers than the majority of the NCAA, with 41% of points allowed being from deep. You mentioned that UB is going to have to shoot the ball a little bit better. Is that, you know, a schematic thing? Are they not shooting the three? Do they, you know, sort of not rely on the three at all and are trying to develop the interior game more? Or is it just the fact that they don't necessarily have the shooters shooting at the clip that they need to have that deep success?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is they just haven't been shooting the ball well from three. But I think one of the focuses for the coach was he wants them to take better threes this year. He thought maybe last year they forced some of them and took some bad threes. So I think they're going to take fewer three-pointers this year than last year in general. Now, the one thing that happened in the last week and a half is that Keyshawn Bruton became eligible. He had transferred from Coastal Carolina, where he was their second leading scorer last year. And initially he was planning on sitting out this entire season and just redshirting. And then the NCAA made the determination that, you know, you're going to get your year back because of COVID. So they decided maybe Keyshawn should go ahead and play. They got the waiver. And so he's played in a couple of games now, and he's a 3-point sniper. Now, he's taken, honestly, some bad threes in the first two games, in my opinion. But I think he's somebody that could maybe change those numbers a little bit, because he's had big games in the past against really good teams shooting threes. It looks like he's a little bit up and down when it comes to shooting them. But if he gets on one of those hot stretches, it could be tough for somebody to stop him because of his ability to shoot from outside. And I think he's a little bit of the wild card right now. You know, if he goes off on Saturday, that could spell a little bit of trouble, I think, for SU. But he hasn't necessarily been hot from downtown yet.
All right. So I want to try to put you in the shoes of the UB coaches. You're in the locker room before the game against Syracuse, and you say, guys, this is the key to beating the Orange today. What's the main key?
I don't know if it's just one thing, but I think they're going to have to make some threes. I mean, it sounds simple, but I think they're going to have to make some threes, which they hadn't done the first four games. And then they did against Miami in the conference opener, which may have been due in large part to the Redhawks not looking like they were ready to go, quite frankly. But I don't think there's any one thing you can pin it on, because Syracuse is good enough that it's not just going to come down to whether Buffalo makes shots. Buffalo's also going to have to play good defense against Syracuse as well. I think one thing that will be interesting to look at also is rebounding, because Buffalo, even though they'll be undersized against Syracuse, has historically been a really, really good rebounding team. They've hit the offensive glass especially well. And, you know, against a zone, or sometimes teams that play zone don't do a great job of preventing their opponents from grabbing offensive rebounds. So, you know, maybe there's an area that Buffalo could take advantage of on Saturday also, but who knows what's going to happen.
We'll flip the switch here. You're now, you know, replacing Jim Boeheim for a second. What's the best way to approach playing UB in this situation, and how do you attack that team?
Yeah, I think, if I'm Syracuse, I just do what I've been doing probably, you know, and which is, I'm sure, what they're going to do anyway. I don't think Coach Boeheim's going to change anything up too much from how he's done it the last 100 years. So, that makes it pretty easy for them, I guess. Buffalo doesn't, it's like everybody else, you know, they don't see zones very often. So it can be funky to go up against that. And it'll be interesting to see how Buffalo does in trying to attack it on Saturday. I mean, you know, it comes down to that so often against Syracuse, because nobody sees it, or at least you rarely see it. Buffalo does have the unique situation being in the MAC, that when they play Eastern Michigan with Rob Murphy, the former Syracuse assistant coach, they do see that exact same zone defense at least once a season. So they get a look at it once a year anyway, but who knows? I mean, it's really difficult to predict. You know, Buffalo's given Syracuse a couple of pretty good games the last few years, including the win 2 years ago. So We'll see what happens this time.
Yes, we will. Josh, thank you so much for coming on and taking the time today. We wish you the best the rest of the season and until, you know, this vaccination makes its way around town.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
One more thank you to Josh Wetzel for coming on and giving us the information with regards to this Bulls squad that gave Syracuse a big loss a couple of years ago and a decent run 3 years back. And that was a different team and something that we definitely are not going to be able to see all of the most similarities between that squad and what we'll see come Saturday, but an interesting situation nonetheless, and a game that can easily be dropped by Syracuse because of the defensive success that the Bulls have seen in terms of guarding the three so far in the early going here in the fresh season. Ben, Syracuse needs to make a change. And it's something that we alluded to with a little bit of fun over at the Ostrom Avenue Pod Twitter. So let's dump into that a little bit and sort of see where the improvements need to come from for the Orange.
Yeah, so yesterday at Ostrom Avenue Pod, we put out a poll at halftime. This was when Syracuse was tied with Northeastern, and I think a lot of people thought it would maybe distance itself in the second half, but it did not. But Syracuse said, or we said about Syracuse, what do they need to do here to get some space in the second half? And there were four options: 3-point shooting as a team, rebounding, Alan Griffin having a better individual impact, or Buddy Boeheim having a better individual impact. Well, Syracuse shot 0-for-7 from three in the second half. They did not win the rebounding battle. I mean, they won by one. I don't really consider that to win the rebounding battle. They eked out a rebounding win. Alan Griffin ended the game with 0 points, and Buddy Boeheim ended the game with 2 points. So none of those happened there, but maybe one of them can happen in this game. And I think the most important one is Alan Griffin doing something. I think Alan Griffin needs to have more of an impact. You know, Buddy and 3-point shooting tie in together a little bit because there are very few times when Buddy gets going and it isn't from three. But Alan, even if he's not hitting threes, you know, he said he wants to be more than just a 3-point shooter, then he should be able to get to the rim, get fouled. You know, I look at Kadari Richmond last game. He didn't make a shot, but he scored 5 points. You have to be able to find a way to get yourself going, even on those bad 3-point shooting nights, if you want to be a leading scorer on a team in the ACC. And Alan Griffin has to do that next game against Buffalo.
I'm going to take a sort of cop-out / cheating answer here and say they need to improve from three, because that sort of works as a coverall for 75% of our options there. I think they need to figure it out. And when you've got the number of 3-point shooters that Syracuse has in terms of Alan Griffin, in terms of Joe Girard, in terms of Buddy Boeheim, and even, you know, production from Kadari Richmond and Quincy Guerrier, and Woody Newton has shot the ball really well in his limited minutes. I think if you can improve that number as a whole, then that's going to be where your success comes from. It doesn't have to be Syracuse shooting 50% from deep every night. That's not going to be a sustainable way to keep yourself in games, but got to be able to get, you know, 23 or 25% shooting nights from three out of your arsenal. So if you're going to be able to shoot somewhere in a 30 to 50% range night in and night out, obviously 50 being really high, but I mean, 30 to 45% night in and night out, that's where you need to be. You cannot continue to have these sort of low tier game by game numbers. When you look at, you know, the three or four closest games for Syracuse, Bryant, they shot under 30%. Niagara, they shot under 22%. Rutgers, they shot under 27%. And Northeastern, they shot 11% from three. So their close games and their games where they're inefficient from three are really where the struggles come from. So that's got to be their key. That's got to be their fix, because that's where their success can come from as a whole. And you can sort of escape one or two of the guys having a bad game. So yesterday, if Joe plays really well and shoots the ball really well from three, it was 2-for-9, which is not horrid, but it's not where you want him to be. You can't, I mean, it's not going to be an often or a frequent situation where you've got Joe Girard, Buddy Boeheim, and Alan Griffin shooting, I believe, what was it, like 0-for-7 plus 2-for-9 is like a 2-for-16 clip as a squad, shooting 12.5% out of your big three from deep. That is not sustainable, and that is not something that Syracuse is going to be able to win games in conference play doing.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to me, honestly, with the exception of Rutgers, if Syracuse beats Buffalo, technically Georgetown is also non-conference, but if Syracuse beats Buffalo and survives this non-conference schedule, with the way they've been playing, it looks like they should have lost a game because of the inconsistency. And, you know, I think last year I remember us talking along with Brendan, and we were saying, you know, this isn't a typical Syracuse team last year. They weren't necessarily shooting for that many upsets, but having some letdowns. They were kind of just winning in the middle. I think we're back a little bit to the norm here, where Syracuse is sometimes going to shoot the lights out, and maybe, you know, maybe it comes as a huge win against BC. Maybe it comes as a win against, you know, a Duke or North Carolina. But I think sometimes they're not going to be able to hit anything, and then it's going to come in the form of, you know, potentially a loss to a Buffalo or maybe one of the lower ACC teams like a Georgia Tech.
The return of the post NCAA sanctioned Syracuse basketball team. They can win any game, they can lose any game, and it seems like they are right back in that wagon here in the fresh season. For Ben Shulman, Owen Valentine, this has been the Ostrom Avenue Podcast. Give us a follow over on Twitter at Ostrom Avenue Pod. Got a lot of content coming out over there. And while you're hitting your like buttons, hitting your subscribe buttons, give us a subscription wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you're, you know, clicking and listening in the car or wherever. Give us a rating. Give us a review. We really appreciate those. It's been a lot of fun. Good conversations today. Good conversations moving forward. A lot up in the air with regards to Syracuse basketball, and it all is back up and going on Saturday as Syracuse looks for its revenge against a UB team that got the better of it two seasons ago. For Ben Shulman, I'm Owen Valentine. Thanks so much for listening. We'll catch you next week.